It is clear that the Cuban actions yesterday were a blatant violation of international law and a violation of the norms of civilized behavior. Cuban explanations of why they took the actions they did are neither plausible nor acceptable.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher condemns Cuba's downing of U.S. civilian planes. Cuba says it has proof the pilots flew into Cuban airspace. Today, we'll ask a Cuban official why they took such a move, and we'll analyze the political repercussions here at home. Also, Arizona's primary is tomorrow. We'll look at the growing wise use movement in Arizona, where Pat Buchanan is appealing to the anti-environmental cause.
You give me your help, give me your hearts, my friend, on Tuesday here in Arizona. Listen, you give me your hands and hearts, we'll do it. We'll send Bill and Hillary. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We've got to add one guy out of it. We've got to add one species to the Endangered Species Act. Bruce Babbitt's going on the Endangered Species Act.
And Money Talks, our weekly segment on how big bucks are affecting the political agenda. All that coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Pacifica's national grassroots daily election show. On Saturday, Steve Forbes won the Delaware primary. While the multi-billionaire is financing his own campaign, he is getting some help. We'll take a look at some of the investment companies investing in Forbes. Then Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky is in Arizona just before tomorrow's primary there. Among the activists he'll be talking to are a group that's been the target of repeated death threats. And finally, responding to Cuba's downing of two U.S. planes, which Cuba says entered its waters, we'll talk with a Cuban official, a U.S. military expert who just returned from Cuba, Pacifica's Saul Landau, and Reverend Lucius Walker, on the sixth day of a fast on the U.S.-Mexican border. He's protesting the U.S. customs seizure of 400 computers headed for Cuba. That's all on today's Democracy Now! Moving into our first segment, If It's Monday, It's Money. In order to become president today, you must, for all practical purposes, do one of two things: raise millions of dollars from the economically interested or finance your own political campaign. This means that our presidential candidates have not been selected by the people as a whole, but by lawyers and lobbyists and the entertainment industry, by the Wall Street securities firms, insurance and gambling interests, by healthcare conglomerates and the oil and gas industry. And if anyone thinks these economically interested contributors are going to melt into the background after Election Day, you're kidding yourselves. Joining us to talk about money in presidential politics is Ellen Miller, executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, one of the few groups following the money in presidential politics and what this means for our democracy. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ellen.
It's great to be here.
Well, why don't we begin with that question? What does this kind of money mean for democracy?
Well, I think we have to start really at the beginning and look at how few people give money that is meaningful in politics, whether it's presidential politics or congressional politics. We know that less than one-third of 1% of the American people make a campaign contribution of $200 or more in congressional elections. That's less than one-third of 1%. We are talking about a very tiny minority of people who select our candidates for presidents or for the presidential race or for congressional races. What this means ultimately is that that money skews who our candidates are, and it skews public policy making once the election is over. So, you know, we're drifting toward an election system which is very much in the hands of the wealthy and the economically interested. The vast majority of us have no say in candidate selection.
How did this whole way of campaign financing begin? How did we evolve the system?
Well, the current campaign finance system, which is really more loophole than law at the moment, is a result of reforms in the 1970s, the post-Watergate reforms, which were worthy in and of themselves, but they had problems because they simply did not go far enough. For example, they decided that a reasonable contribution limit, a non-corrupting one, was at $1,000. But nobody in this country can give $1,000. Actually, it's about 160,000 people out of 260 million who make a contribution of $1,000 or more. So those those 70s reforms set the limit of what you could give at such a high level that very few people could can contribute and can we call pay to play in this political system.
And this was in reaction to Watergate?
This was in reaction to Watergate, where there were bags, brown bags of, you know, of cash going under the table at the White House to buy political influence. What, in fact, the Watergate reforms did was to make it perfectly legal to write checks for that amount, and now they go over the tables at the White House and, of course, you know, in congressional offices as well.
And also, wasn't the whole system of PACs, political action committees, set up then?
Very much so. Political action committees were thought to be a way of getting greater disclosure and greater understanding of the campaign finance system and put it sort of above the table, as it were. And, in fact, in some ways, the PAC system has worked reasonably well. It's pretty easy to identify, but PACs only give 25% of the money for congressional campaigns. The far larger source is this money that comes from large individual contributors whose interest we identify quite neatly as lining up with those of the PACs. It's harder to follow. It's limitless because of bundling, the ability to walk up and down the halls of a Wall Street security firm or a Hollywood studio and collect $1,000 contributions. This is not money coming from ordinary folks.
Now, when you say bundling, you mean collecting all those thousands of dollars and then what? And then giving it
over?
And
then giving it, handing it in one single
bundle. But it looks like it's a bunch of individuals.
That's correct. But when we do our analysis, we can often find, you know, all the executives of U.S. Tobacco giving to the same day to the same candidate. And that's quite a typical pattern. It's not just the tobacco industry, but we find it both for Democratic candidates and Republican candidates.
Let's go to some specifics. This past Saturday, Steve Forbes had his first win, and that was the Democratic primary, Delaware primary. Tell us about Steve Forbes. Now, most people know that he is spending his own money, I think, to the tune of something like, so far, $26 million, and they think that that's it. But in fact, he is getting other money, isn't he?
Well, that's right. One of the interesting things that came to light was that it was not that Steve Forbes is sort of giving himself a grant for this campaign. He's actually loaning himself the money, which means that if he is successful, he can be paid back by anyone who wants to invest in him. Now, you know, what we're looking at, the Steve Forbes phenomenon represents one of two ways you can get into presidential politics. Either you can build your campaigns on the wallets of the rich and interested. Bob Dole is a great example of that, so is Alexander. Or you can be the rich and interested and finance your own campaign. But Forbes is really paving the way for a third way, which is you can pay your own campaign expenses. But you can also allow others, other economically interested folks, to invest in you. And that's what Forbes has done. By the end of last year, he had raised, I think, about $1.8 million in private money. Now, you know, one might think that this is a grassroots kind of effort, but in fact, it's not. Our analysis shows that a lot of the Wall Street securities firms, like Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, Salomon Brothers, Payne Webber, have invested in his campaign to the tune of, you know, at least $2 million thus far. And what's fascinating about it is that these very same Wall Street firms have invested in other candidates. So first, frankly, they went to Bob Dole. And now that they're beginning to see a weakening in that campaign, they're thinking, hey, we better find another horse to ride. And so they're starting to give money to Steve Forbes.
And isn't the largest receiver of investment company money actually President Clinton?
That's right. The Wall Street firms illustrate another great adage about money in politics, which is this is not money that is ideologically driven. It is driven because they want access and influence with whoever is in the White House. And if that's going to be a Democrat, well, they're perfectly content with a Democrat in the White House.
You know, yesterday when I was watching these Sunday talk shows on television, one of the questioners was asking Pat Buchanan why he emphasizes Goldman Sachs when he talks about Wall Street, suggesting that he had a kind of anti-Semitic tinge to what he was saying as he talked about Goldman Sachs. But the fact is, and even Pat Buchanan didn't say this, Goldman Sachs is the number one contributor to President Clinton's campaign.
Well, they certainly were in the last election cycle. In the 1992 cycle, Goldman Sachs was way and above the largest contributor to Bill Clinton. And interestingly, one of the partners, former partners of Goldman Sachs, of course, is now Secretary Treasurer Bob Rubin. You know, Goldman Sachs is just a terrific example, but it is not an exclusive example. Bill Clinton in this election cycle has certainly much larger campaign contributors. Actually, the top contributor It comes from the accounting firm of Ernst & Young for Bill Clinton this time. And so, you know, they may bounce all over depending on, you know, who the fundraiser is and what they might want after Election Day. But the most important point is we are not ordinary people funding these election campaigns. These candidates have been selected by the wealthy and the interested, those who want something in return after Election Day. The vast majority of the people are not on this radar screen. The other thing I want to add is, you know, money will not necessarily buy an election. I've never quite believed that. But it is absolutely necessary for getting into the game. If Phil Gramm did not have that $20 million as his goal, and he ultimately achieved it, he would not have been regarded as a viable presidential candidate. But it couldn't buy him votes, and it couldn't buy him love, so he's dropped out. I would suspect that if there are other Steve Forbes out there and they cannot finance their own campaign, you know, they're not even on our radar screen. Maury Taylor, another, you know, sort of almost unheard of candidate, is financing his own campaign. He gets in debates. But the question is, does this man have anything to offer to us? The only reason he's there is because he's got a fat wallet.
We're talking to Ellen Miller, who's executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics based here in Washington, D.C. You know, on Friday, I was on C-SPAN debating the American Enterprise Institute, the editor of the American Enterprise, which is their magazine. And when I brought up the issue of money in politics, he responded that we pay less for candidates than we do for bubblegum in this country. It's hardly something to get upset about. What's your response to that?
Well, the answer to that is, you know, it's an apples and oranges kind of analogy. First of all, you know, I think relating how much we spend in sort of a capital, you know, in the capital economy on goods and services has no relationship to what we spend in terms of politics. You know, that argument suggests that if we spent more money, we'd have more information, which I think is patently absurd, you know, given 1996 politics and the fact that we know that they're spending all of their money on, you know, on negative advertising, which doesn't give anyone any information. And I suspect, frankly, if we could change the system we have for campaign finance, we'd spend a lot less money on yogurt and antacids than we would on spending politics. It's an absolutely irrelevant comparison.
Would you recommend that the networks would have to run free advertising? I mean, is that the bulk of the cost of campaigns is television ads?
Depending on what level of campaign, depends on how much candidates actually spend on media. Presidential campaigns spend more. House campaigns, for example, spend only about 20% of their money on media advertising. Of course, the airwaves belong to the people, and the folks who are running their commercial shows ought to give some of this time back to candidates. This is a democracy. In fact, you know, what better use could we actually have of the money? That's one major piece of it, but it wouldn't replace all the money that is necessary for a political campaign. The issue is the conflict between the private financing of public elections. And when you have private financiers like Wall Street, like Hollywood, like lawyers, like accountants, and you have so few people giving money, then you have this inevitable conflict as well as, you know, a host of other problems.
Mm-hmm. Coming up on Democracy Now!, we're going to Arizona, to Tucson, where Larry Bensky is standing by, and we're going to be talking about environmental issues. After that, we're dealing with the issue of Cuba and what this means for presidential politics. We'll be going to the Mexican-American border, where a group of people are on a hunger strike because they can't get their computers, part of a Cuba caravan, to Cuba. This at the same time that the U.S. is now enmeshed in quite a controversy with Cuba. The U.N. Security Council. The U.S. is pushing for it to criticize Cuba for downing two U.S. planes. And Cuba has just come out with some new information saying it's got one of the pilots involved with the group that had its planes downed. And we're going to be talking about what all this means. But right now, we're talking with the Center for Responsive Politics, Ellen Miller. And they have a study out called The First Primary, Early Fundraising in the 1996 Presidential Election. Overall, what did you find in this?
Well, we found that every candidate had a particularly large economically interested backer. We found that industries and interest groups had picked their candidate. For example, Bill Clinton was the favorite of the lawyers and lobbyists in D.C., but Phil Graham was the favorite of the health professionals. So the question is where that money will go at this point. We found that the securities and investment industry had invested heavily in each of the candidates. We looked at where the money was coming from geographically, and surprisingly, for example, we found that, or perhaps not surprisingly, some of the candidates, like Alexander, were regional favorites. About half of his money came from Tennessee and very little from any place else. One of the other fascinating things in this study is to look at Pat Buchanan's money. I mean, we tend to think that there are problems when money comes from the economically interested, the wealthy elite of the country. How much large individual money is coming, you know, and where it's coming from. But for Pat Buchanan, in fact, individuals who gave under $200 comprised about 80% of his money. And so he is raising a lot in small donor money. I mean, no doubt he has the lists that belong to some of the more conservative, indeed right-wing organizations in this country. But from a money politics perspective, this is money that is more ideological rather than economically interested driven. It also says a lot about the Buchanan campaign, which is it's a low-budget campaign. He's raising money in small increments. There are a lot of people who will give, you know, $10, $20, $25, small amounts, to a campaign, and it could sustain him much further than some of the other candidates who are raising big bucks.
For Buchanan, aside from those $200 contributions, what are the big contributors? Who has been funding Pat Buchanan's campaign?
Well, his single largest contributor is Milliken and Company. His second largest contributor was Lay Fibers. So we're looking at textile industries, you know, that are supportive, I suppose, of his protectionist trade policies. A lot of smaller organizations and interest groups that really do not appear on the major radar screen of, you know, in the money and politics community. His backing looks quite different than most people. One of the other things, I don't want to go too far in terms of what might be deemed as praise of his campaign contribution profile, he did only identify about 50% of his contributors. And that is something that is required by law. At least candidates have to make what's called their best effort at identification. So he could do an awful lot better in that realm.
Clinton, I notice one of the things that came out of your report, financial sector tops presidential giving, Clinton cashes in with lawyers, is that in addition to law firms that figure prominently on his list, Clinton also received over $145,000 from employees of the federal government and their immediate families, particularly the Department of Agriculture. Why?
Very interesting. Not altogether clear to us. We often do not know what is driving, the campaign contributions. We simply report on it. We'll hand it over to reporters and say, you figure this out. But interestingly, there was a bit of a scandal in the 1992 race in which members or government employees of the Agriculture Department were discovered to have been giving a substantial amount of money to the Clinton campaign. And interestingly, at least the allegation goes, a number of them got raises and increases in their particular position. This is something that's been investigated by The Hill. And, the question is whether there's some lurking scandal here. It strikes me as somewhat unusual.
Well, Ellen, we're going to have you back next Monday to talk about soft money. You're going to be coming out with a report then. And if people want to get more information, do you have a number that they can call or a website or an email address?
Well, I think the easiest way for people on the email is to write us at info@crp.org. And we can send out to you a brochure of our information and a publications list, or they can call us at 202-857-0044.
And again, info@crp.org, that's O-R-G, or you can phone in Washington, 202-857-0044. Ellen Miller is the executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics. She'll be back next week to talk about soft money. Thanks for joining us on Democracy Now!
give me your help, give me your hearts, my friend, on Tuesday here in Arizona. If we can win the Arizona primary, we break in, we'll go into South Carolina. And just days after that, you break out into the open, Georgia, Colorado, Maryland, Yankee primary. A week later, through the South, through Super Tuesday. We'll go rolling along that Gulf Coast and the Pat Buchanan Express. We'll set that place on fire. Listen, you give me your hands and hearts, we'll do it, and we'll send Bill and Hillary. I tell you what we're going to do. We've got to add one guy to that. We've got to add one species to the Endangered Species Act. Bruce Babbitt's going on the Endangered Species Act.
Republican candidate Pat Buchanan in Arizona this weekend, where National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky is in also. And this morning he is in Tucson following the Republican candidates. Over the weekend, he saw Pat Buchanan at the People for the West convention in Tempe. Joining us to discuss the Arizona primary and especially the environmental issues in the campaign are Carolyn Campbell, a former Green Party candidate for the state legislature and a member of the board of the Center for Voting and Democracy, and Kieran Suckling, head of the Southwest Center for Biological Diversity. Larry, welcome to Democracy Now! This morning.
Great to be back.
Who are the People for the West, and what was Pat Buchanan doing talking to them?
People for the West, Amy, is an industry-funded citizens organization, and if that sounds like a contradiction in terms, it probably is. 96% of their funding comes from corporate sources, according to a study by the Audubon Society. Corporations like Chevron USA, Homestake Mining, Kennecott Copper, some of which corporations give up to $100,000 to support this so-called citizens organization. In the past, they've been linked to the Wise Use Movement, the Christian Identity Movement, and many other far-right groups in the west of the United States. But at this weekend's convention, they weren't showing that face. They were showing their face of wanting to elect Pat Buchanan president by helping to get him the Republican nomination. They claim to now have 25,000 members throughout the West, and their largest chapter is here in Arizona, they say, with some 2,500 members in 26 chapters. They spent a lot of time at their convention in Tempe on Saturday excoriating environmentalists, and especially the Southwest Center for Biological Diversity, whom they called environmental extremists. They said if the Southwest Center had its way, there would be no more extractive use of lands, and that their motto, the People for the West motto of keeping our public lands open, couldn't happen. Kieran Suckling, what exactly are you doing to get these people so jumping up and down?
Well, I think protecting the environment a little too vigorously here in Arizona and throughout the Southwest, and especially when that touches on the three bases of the Wise Use Movement here, which is mining, logging, and ranching, has raised the hackles of these folks.
Could you speak up a little, Kieran?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Our group has done a lot of aggressive work to protect public lands here in Arizona.
What do you mean by aggressive work?
We do a lot of litigation. We do a lot of appeal of timber sales and mining projects and grazing allotments.
Now, several of the people that I spoke to at the convention were very, very concerned about their own livelihoods. These are people who have lived on and off the land for generations, and say that the whole economy of Arizona would collapse if the Southwest Center had its way. Let's listen for a moment to one of those people, a woman named Linda Dean, who is a co-chair of the chapter of People for the West that is located around Kearney, Arizona.
The truth is that multiple land use is a good thing for our country. It's important to keep our mining industries and our cattle industries and our farmers working and our oil men. They are the wealth of our nation, and they make our industries grow. They pay paychecks beyond your copper man goes to work, and he gets a wage, and he pays insurance, and suppliers are purchased. There's tools, there's insurance, properties, homes are bought, taxes are paid. I mean, the billions of dollars that are input by these industries, it's just not known.
What about that, Kieran? Is the entire economy of Arizona going to collapse if the lawsuits?
Well, I'd love to know where the billions of dollars came in. I somehow don't think it will. I mean, if you look at just one industry, for example, logging, it provides only 300 jobs in Arizona. It's a tiny portion of our economy. we're a desert state, and the jobs that are provided get a small proportion of the money that's being made. You know, i.e., our timber industry here is dominated by multinational corporations like Stone Forest Industries, for example. So it's a really small part of Arizona's economy, and furthermore, it's not as if it's being eradicated. It's an incredible hysteria being generated on the part of these folks when what's happening is, for the first time, the public is getting involved in the management of public lands, and the private corporations aren't real pleased about that.
Well, you seem to have a lot of political opposition on the other side, on the People for the West side. For example, the governor of the state of Arizona, Fife Symington, addressed the convention. And also addressing the convention was a man named Jim Irvin, a conservative Republican who's running for the Corporations Commission here in Arizona. Corporations Commission is a statewide body which, as I understand it, has great regulatory powers about what industry does and doesn't do. Let's listen for a moment to Jim Irvin giving his little talk to People for the West.
I don't want to be shutting down water, shutting down wells, shutting down small water companies because we got some stupid amoeba in there or some polywog or some fish that some environmentalist from Washington comes out, doesn't even know what they look like, and says this thing's an endangered animal. Who gives a damn?
Now, how about that who gives a damn attitude towards endangered species and other things? Kiran, do you find that widespread here in Arizona?
No, I don't. And in fact, the answer to who gives a damn over and over again has been answered in Arizona that most Arizonans. So we've had a number of environmental polls here in the last few years, and in every instance, the vast majority of Arizonans say we want stronger environmental protection laws. In particular, we want stronger protection for our water and for our forests. And so, in fact, the vast majority of our state is in favor of environmental protection. Unfortunately, we've got a governor, we've got a state legislature, and we have many appointees who are really in the pockets of industry, and these are the folks that you're hearing down there.
Let's bring Carolyn Campbell into this. Carolyn, you're with the Green Party here in Arizona, and you're now engaged in a statewide campaign to get Ralph Nader on the ballot, for which you need relatively few signatures. Isn't that correct?
Well, we need about 15,000 signatures of registered voters to get on the ballot here this year, 96.
That's not very many when you consider there's something like 2 million registered voters in this state.
Right, yeah. In Arizona, I think this Ralph Nader for President campaign has really had a good impact on the Green Party. You know, sometimes we wonder where people like Ralph Nader have been because everything that we're saying makes sense and is the only hope for the future. But we know it takes a while to really have a national impact. But we're really proud that he's going to be joining us here. And so we're out collecting signatures to get on the ballot, to get Ralph Nader on the ballot, and, of course, also to run local campaigns as well.
Well, now let me ask you the classic third-party question then. Arizona is a state that is very Republican. In fact, in presidential elections, it's the most Republican in the country. It hasn't gone for a Democrat since 1948. That's the longest of any state in the country. Recent polls, which may not mean much this far ahead of the election, show that if the election were held now, President Clinton would defeat Bob Dole, would defeat Pat Buchanan, would defeat anybody here in Arizona. But you're trying to put somebody on the ballot who has a chance of getting 3, 4, 5%, maybe more, and would assure the Republicans of winning again here in Arizona. Is that part of your calculation, that you may be helping Republicans get elected if you have Ralph Nader on the ballot?
Well, that's, of course, like you say, a classic argument. First of all, we're trying to change the election system, too, and I think the Republicans are seeing that in the primary here tomorrow, that somebody like Pat Buchanan can win, 23% of the votes and win all of the electors' votes here in Arizona. So I think that the votes, even though a Republican has won for president every time, I think that the votes are a little bit skewed because someone can win not even a majority, but, 25, 30% of the people that are actually voting and can elect a Republican candidate for president. What we're trying to do, what we've always tried to do, is wake up a lot of those people that just gave up. You know, the lesser of two evils, the only reason people go to vote these days is to defeat somebody that's even worse. And so there's, as everyone knows, there's just not that many people voting anymore because people people just don't think it's going to make a difference. And so, actually, I think that Ralph Nader, he's not a known presidential candidate to most of the country yet, but when he is, I think there's going to be a lot of people at voting that would have stayed home.
One thing people don't seem to realize about Arizona, and I must say I didn't before I came here a few days ago, is how urban a state this is. You think of it as part of the Southwest and the wide open spaces, but 85% of the voters live in Phoenix and Tucson. The rural areas are relatively depopulated. Only 12% of the population lives in rural areas. Kieran Suckling, are you able to get support in urban areas for environmental preservation greater than you can out in the rural areas where the People for the West and the Wise Use Movement seem to have an impact?
Yeah, that's generally true. In fact, we recently moved our group from a very rural area into Tucson just a few months ago, largely because we want to do mass organizing, and we're getting better support in the urban areas. But one of the things we've also found is almost any rural area you go to in Arizona has its own homegrown environmental group there. You go to the White Mountains, which is in eastern Arizona, real heart of the Wise Use Movement, and you've got the White Mountain Conservation League, a very strong and active group there. However, what generally happens is that the Wise Use Movement brings the voices of extraction from the rural areas to the cities, and they say, hey, these are what the rural people feel. And what happens, I think, generally is that even liberal-minded folks in the city have a tendency to listen to that voice.
Well, because they put a human face on what they say is the suffering of people who are living in rural areas, and they presented several of these at their convention over the weekend, and I interviewed some of them, and I must say they didn't seem like Hollywood actors to me. They seemed very sincere people who were tremendously afraid that they would lose their jobs and their homes. What do you say to those people?
Well, generally, what we try to do is point out to them, you know, that the actual economic conditions that put them where they are. You look at Arizona. We used to have over 200 sawmills in Arizona, operated by dozens of different local corporations. Today, we've got 3 logging companies in Arizona. All of them are massive corporations. And so folks have very few places to go for employment because they've been taken over by corporations. And consequently, when the profit margin is not high enough, these places close down. We've seen that time and time again. Stone Container is a classic one who will continually close their mills at a very ripe political moment in order to make a statement and create lots of hysteria. And then a month later, open it up again when it's politically okay to do that.
Carolyn Campbell, the Green Party, when you try to appeal to people in urban areas, what do you find the reaction is? I'm asking this because I spoke to some of the people who are canvassing for Kieran's organization, and they told me that sometimes when they knock on doors, they get a really hostile reception.
Well, we've found the opposite, really. We've knocked on a lot of doors in our campaigns, and what we're finding now in terms of the mainstream Arizonans is that people, all this rhetoric, the anti-environmental rhetoric that was happening in the 80s is really getting, trying to be pushed ahead now in the 90s, and people are really waking up. People are saying environmental protection laws, you know, not just the Endangered Species Act, but all the Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, all the environmental protection laws have been with us for, you know, close to, 25 years now, and people really think that they're, you know, part of their unalienable rights almost, and they can't believe that this is being challenged at this point. So they've been quiet in the 80s and shook their heads, but now they're really, this is what's really struck a chord with the mainstream now, and so people are coming out and standing up. People that have not considered themselves activists before, they're saying, wow, if government isn't for anything else, it should be protecting the health and protecting our environment. And I think people, just like Kieran said, the anti-environmental agenda is not popular with the American people, and the politicians that are pushing it must know that. I mean, they must be just doing this for some of their big corporate sponsors, because if they don't realize that this is an anti, this isn't popular, then I don't know where. They're either ignorant of it or they just don't care.
Carolyn Campbell of the Arizona Green Party, Kiran Suckling from the Southwest Center for Biological Diversity are our guests this morning on Democracy Now! We have just a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to get each of your reactions to something that I've noticed since I've been here in Arizona, which is the very monolithic nature of the news media here. There's very little alternative media. There are weekly papers in Tucson and Phoenix. I don't know how widely read they are. There's no alternative radio to speak of. There's certainly no alternative television. And the news media coverage of this Republican convention has really been extremely conventional, I might say, as an understatement. Do you have trouble getting the word out, Kiran and Carolyn, about your environmental campaigns here in Arizona?
I'll answer that first, Carolyn. We actually don't have any trouble at all, and I think that's a really good indicator that our papers are not just mainstream, frankly. Many of them are fairly right-wing. However, they're also quite environmental. And what it shows you is that Arizonans who have traditionally voted Republican are not voting against the environment. So, for example, papers like the Arizona Republic, a very conservative newspaper, will run editorials saying stop the chainsaw massacre. In Tucson, the large paper down here covers our issues on a regular basis. So we don't have any problem getting the message out through these kinds of
How about the Green Party, Carolyn?
Well, Larry, I'm going to argue with you, too. You're here right at the time where the Republicans are having their primary, and I know that's all over the media. But when we had our campaigns a couple years ago, it was quite refreshing. You know, I know we were a new party then, and perhaps a lot of it was a novelty with the television media. They had a lot of coverage of the Green Party. And when we had our candidates were endorsed not only by, you know, a lot of the interest groups that Sierra Club and Now and things like that, but all of the print media was endorsed by the more liberal morning daily paper as well as the more conservative daily afternoon paper. That was quite a surprise. As well as the alternative weekly and the gay publication, basically all of the print media endorsed my candidacy, and I really feel also, you know, we don't have a Green Party presidential candidate right now here in Arizona, and when we do, I hope that it gets covered. I think that's probably where the Green Party had the most impact back in '92, because now I see that the media is all covering pretty fairly libertarian candidates and independent candidates a lot more so than they did before our Green Party campaign. So I'm actually, at least locally, I'm encouraged.
Well, on that note, I want to thank both of you for joining us and maybe have a little chat here for a moment myself with Amy Goodman about the Arizona primary itself coming up tomorrow evening and night. We will have results, of course, on Democracy Now! Later this week and analysis of how it turned out. But right now, to get back to the horse race, it looks like the three horses that you might expect are all contesting for the lead. But one of the things that's proven most interesting to me is that how little voter interest, Amy, there seems to be in this primary out here in Arizona. Among Republicans, there are almost 1 million registered Republicans in this state. And
now, Larry, it is just a Republican primary?
Right, it is just a Republican primary. But the Registrar of Voters is saying that they expect fewer than 100,000 people out of 1 million to participate in this, despite the media blitz, and it is intense. I mean, you can't turn on a television set for 2 seconds without seeing a political ad from Dole or Buchanan or especially Forbes. But there's very little real voter interest among Republicans on the ground, it seems.
Well, we were just talking about money in politics, and I fear that's what has the most to do with it, is how removed these elections are. And I think we're going to be bringing on Francis Pox Piven one of these days to talk about why people don't vote, because that seems to be one of the most significant factors in this and the Iowa primary as well. Larry, thank you for joining us this morning. Larry Bensky, Pacifica's National Affairs Correspondent, speaking to us from Tucson, Arizona. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about Cuba and presidential politics. This is Democracy Now! and you're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Cuba today accused the U.S. government of lying and says it has unequivocal proof that two U.S. civilian planes it shot down Saturday were inside Cuban airspace at the time. Cuba's foreign ministry was responding directly to U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher, who said yesterday the planes were in international waters when they were downed. In addition, Cuba says it has a pilot from the, quote, group of violators which have carried out so many actions against our country. The Cuban statement did not specifically say this person was one of the four pilots aboard the downed planes or that he had been picked up at sea. No survivors have been reported so far. The wording indicates the Cuban authorities have with them a member of the Brothers to the Rescue, the Miami-based volunteer pilots group whose planes had been involved in Saturday's incident. The statement said up to a few hours ago he was with them. The pilot knows a lot. Foreign diplomats in Havana say it was possible the Cubans were preparing to present a member of the Brothers to the Rescue group, who up to now had been working with the group in Miami, but was in fact a Cuban government agent. Joining us to talk about what is going on right now in Cuba and here and its ramifications for presidential politics are four people. We're joined by Miguel Nunez of the Cuban Interest Section in Washington, D.C. Because the U.S. doesn't have diplomatic relations with Cuba, the Cuba Interest Section is part of the Swiss Embassy. We're also joined in the studio by retired Admiral Eugene Carroll of the Center for Defense Information. We're joined also in the studio by Saul Landau, who is a Pacifica News analyst and a Cuba expert. And also on the phone speaking to us from the Mexican-U.S. border is Reverend Lucius Walker, who is founder of Pastors for Peace. And he is stuck at the border, part of a fast right now in the sixth day of a hunger fast, protesting the fact that U.S. customs agents have seized 400 computers that his Cuba caravan has been attempting to get to Cuba. And we welcome you all to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Miguel Nunez of the Cuban Interest Section. Tell us, what is the latest? What is your government saying?
Well, many thanks for this opportunity. I like that the listeners could excuse my English. No, I believe that your commentary was accurate. And the reality is that we have proof that the planes were shot down in our airspace, our national airspace, inside of our 12 miles, according with our sovereignty, and as in the past, never Cuba told or said lies about the actions. We are responsible. We assume the responsibility for all of our actions in defense of our sovereignty as a country, and as the international community and the people in the United States know, in every opportunity that we could have any kind of confrontation of difficulties with the United States or in other situations, never our country could tell lies or could tell untrue reports about any kind of situation.
Some are saying that if these planes entered airspace of Cuba, you could have forced them down rather than shot them out of the sky.
Well, the phenomenon with this situation is very awful because we are in during more than 2 years. We insist, we inform, send diplomatic notes to the United States, put it warming in our media about these provocateur actions that is unacceptable for us. If you take into consideration that in 1994 we report 6 illegal actions, violations of our airspace, and we report in 1995 2, and more recently 1996 we report 2 in January, January 9 and January 13, that is not only in our waters, is included the saying that in 1995, over our land, over the Havana province, is not fine to tell us that we don't try to start or not to start to apply a deterrent, a dissuasive action against all of these provocateurs, terrorist group that, as you know, during 37 years develop a different kind of actions against of our country.
Miguel Nunez is of the Cuban Intersection in Washington, D.C., and in just a minute we're going to ask Saul Landau about the history of this group, Brothers to the Rescue, what their record is in Cuba. But I wanted to turn for a minute to retired Admiral Eugene Carroll with the Center for Defense Information, who just a few weeks ago was in Cuba meeting with high-level Cuban officials. In fact, weren't you asked about the possibility of them shooting down one of these planes?
Yes. On the 8th of February, in a discussion with General Rosales del Toro, the chief of staff of the Cuban military, we covered a lot of subjects, but one of them turned out to be what would happen if we shot down one of these intruding aircraft. And my answer to them was it would be a disaster for Cuba, that public opinion would turn against them, and it would possibly cost them heavily in a political or economic sense. By the way, I brought that information back to Washington, that they were at least talking about it, thinking about it, and clearly the record shows that they have informed our government over and over and over again about these incursions and that they resent them and want them to stop.
Retired Admiral Eugene Carroll, of course, is from the U.S. military. What do you think the U.S. military would do if a Cuban plane came into our airspace?
That's a very good question. And the answer is the United States isn't threatened by Cuba. If a plane wandered into our airspace, we wouldn't really feel we were being threatened in any military sense. And I doubt that we would shoot down an intruding unarmed aircraft. It just isn't our style or our in our ethic. The Cubans, on the other hand, are under siege, as they see it. You have to look at it from their point of view. They think the United States is preparing to invade Cuba. They see our reconnaissance planes patrolling all the time, collecting intelligence from Cuba. They see our actions militarily elsewhere. They can't make sense out of this unless the U.S. is intending to attack Cuba. So these planes are just part of a much bigger picture of threat as the Cubans see it.
I was thinking about the Iranian Airbus. It was a number of years ago that the U.S. shot down with the USS Vincennes. Now, that wasn't U.S. airspace, but it was a large civilian plane where hundreds of people were killed.
The fact is that was a professional error. They received certain information, misinterpreted it, and attacked with the missiles, thinking that it was possibly an F-14 fighter plane attacking their ship. So that isn't a very good analogy. I might give you one that is, however. Some years ago, we were operating in the Gulf of Sirte in the Mediterranean, and two Libyan aircraft flew out of Libya into international waters. They took no hostile actions. They threatened nobody in the United States, but we shot them down because we declared them hostile. Now, this shows that hostility apparently lies in the eye of the beholder, and clearly the Cubans in this case interpreted the actions of the Brothers to the Rescue as hostile to Cuban interests.
Let's talk about Brothers to the Rescue. Saul Landau, a Cuba expert, has done several films on Cuba and written numerous articles. Who is this group?
Well, I hate to be called an expert on anything. I think of Eli Culbertson, a bridge expert, you know. But anyway, Brothers to the Rescue was formed back in 1994, ostensibly for the purpose of seeking out the rafters who were leaving Cuba in the late spring and the summer of 1994 to escape to the United States, because of mainly economic conditions had become intolerable in Cuba for many people at that time. And the United States had this welcome mat laid out saying any Cuban who arrives here doesn't have to go through the normal procedure of any other immigrant. You come right in and you're given a green card fast and so on. So Brothers to the Rescue ostensibly were overflying international waters to spot rafters and then, of course, notify the Coast Guard or appropriate vessels to pick them up so they wouldn't drown or be eaten by sharks. However, some of their statements and certainly their actions indicate that they had more than a humanitarian agenda, that they had a political agenda, and very simply that agenda was to overthrow the government of Cuba, to provoke the government of Cuba. And I think that one of the tactics that has been played out for a long time now is to create an incident whereby the United States Armed Forces are drawn into this conflict, which is the only way that some of these sectors in Miami see of arriving as heads of government in Cuba. And I'm talking specifically about Jorge Mascanosa, the head of the Cuban American National Foundation, whose relationship with Brothers to the Rescue is more than close.
And that's Saul Landau from the Institute for Policy Studies and a Pacifica commentator here. You know, looking at how this fits into presidential politics, Republican presidential candidates Robert Dole and Patrick Buchanan both accuse the administration of pursuing a soft-on-Cuba policy. I want to bring Reverend Lucius Walker into this conversation. You can hear the fuzziness of the phone. You can hear the static there as he stands at a payphone on the U.S.-Mexico border, where he and a group of others are in the midst of a hunger fast. They're on their sixth day. They've entered it because the U.S. customs officials have confiscated 400 computers that they're attempting to bring into Cuba. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Reverend Walker.
Thank you, Amy.
Would you describe President Clinton's policy as soft on Cuba?
That's not been our perception. Of course, relative to what may be the rest of that question, we think that there is no clear indication that President Clinton is moving towards normalization of relations or ending the blockade. And it would appear that his position in the presidential election period or the campaign period is to try to appear a little on the tough side and to throw some crumbs to the Cuban right wing in an effort to win the Florida primary and ultimately to have their support for the presidency. We think it's unfortunate that domestic politics is really interfering in a fairly significant, in our judgment, international policy issue, which could have been resolved years ago, early on in Clinton's administration. I think he had a golden foreign policy opportunity when he was not really distinguishing himself by foreign policy, and could have had this issue behind him, but unfortunately he didn't, and now it plagues all of us.
Can you just describe in a minute what has happened to you and the people that you've been with in this Cuba caravan, both in California as you attempt to go down through Mexico to Cuba, and in Vermont in this past 2 months?
Since January 31st, on three separate occasions, two in California, one in Vermont, we have had well over 800 people involved in the effort to deliver approximately 400 computers to Cuba as a part of the InfoMed educational informational system, which would link all of their hospitals online for the purpose of providing inventory information and technical information for operations and surgical operations and hospital procedures. In the past, we have delivered computers for this system and computers for educational systems and for use by churches. The government response on this occasion has been to throw the most massive show of force we have ever seen. In fact, I've not seen this kind of force since the height of the civil rights struggle. We estimate over 1,000 forces from various departments and agencies used sophisticated surveillance equipment, helicopters, various to infiltrate, we threw out at least four persons that we suspected of being agents, provocateurs, one of whom showed up at the Vermont border in uniform. So we've been under siege, as it were, by our own government and two different states, agencies from two different states.
You're listening to...
They've confiscated all of the computers, and we're now in the 6 days, you said, of the fast for life, which we intend to continue until the computers are released.
Reverend Lucius Walker, we just have a minute. We want to give people last comments. Let's go to Saul Landau. Saul, what about President Clinton's Cuba policy? You think this will be a major issue in the presidential campaign?
I don't think it'll last through the presidential campaign. The Florida primary is March 12th. But the policy is the same policy. It's crisis management. There is no Cuba policy. The Cuba policy was privatized back about 15 years ago by President Reagan, and President Clinton has never been able to seize control of that policy. The only time things happen is when crises occur and he is forced to respond. And until he takes charge or some president takes back that policy out of the hands of private forces and out of the hands of congressional toadies who are paid off by those private forces, things aren't really going to change with U.S.-Cuba policy, in my opinion.
Retired Admiral Eugene Carroll, would you describe President Clinton as soft on Cuba?
No, he's not soft on Cuba. He's very courteous and supportive of the Cuban emigres who want to see Castro out of office. The lesson, I think, that should come from this tragic event, the loss of four lives apparently, is that our policy toward Cuba is a failure. It isn't really a policy. It's a domestic political issue. And we should be taking positive and constructive steps now to restore a form of normal relations with Cuba in order to prevent unnecessary events, violence in the future.
Miguel Nunez, we have 15 seconds. Your response.
Well, if you see the situation now, it's not easy to say that President Clinton is soft with Cuba. I think it's not possible to permit that a little group of people in Miami could dictate the foreign policy of the United States.
On that note, we want to thank you very much for joining us, Miguel Nunez, Eugene Carroll, Reverend Lucius Walker, and Saul Landau. That's it for today's edition of Democracy Now! Today, tomorrow, a look at how anti-immigrant sentiment is steering the Arizona primary and how anti-gay and anti-abortion politics will play out in South and North Dakota. I'm Amy Goodman. Join me again tomorrow for another edition of Democracy Now!